Hello and welcome to UCC Translational Medicine Society's radio show and podcast, Narrowing the Void. This show aims to facilitate student learning and foster student engagement in translational medical research by talking to leading experts in the fields of medical research and basic science. My name is Mark Vesey and I am joined with my co-host, Brian Curtin. Today we are joined by Dr. Colette Hand. Colette is a lecturer in the Department of Pathology in UCC. She graduated from UCC with a BSc in microbiology and subsequently completed a PhD in human molecular genetics in UCD. She was a postdoctoral researcher in McGill University, Canada, and has research interests in genetic basis of disease and the identification of novel disease-related genes. So Colette, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Mark and Brian. Happy to be here.
So I suppose to start, Colette, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're doing in UCC?
Okay. So you've given quite a nice introduction there as to who I am. I'm a UCC graduate and did my PhD then in Dublin. And we might come back to that because it ended up not being what I thought it was going to be at all, which is an important point to note and a lesson to be learnt. I was really lucky then and spent a few years in Montreal in Canada doing postdoc research, which was very exciting, and then returned to UCC to the Department of Pathology. So my role there is teaching medical and dental and medical health science students and biomed students about pathology and a little bit about genetics and doing research, and my research focus is really about the genetics of human disease. So I'm a Cork graduate. I'm originally from Tipperary. We live just outside Cork, and that's who I am.
And could you tell us, Colette, why did you choose this career path to begin with, and had you always seen yourself doing this?
I think I was probably always a scientist. I think when I think back, that was very clear to me. I had an amazing science teacher in school. I think a lot of us can track ourselves back to an amazing teacher somewhere. I had a really inspirational teacher, Mr. Crotty, who paid very little attention to a syllabus, which wasn't such a good thing, but had a really good overview and was just interesting and entertained our questions and encouraged our questions up to a point, and really just kind of, I suppose, brought science alive and made us have that interest, you know. So I blame it mostly on him, if I'm honest. So science was always on the cards, I suppose. And then I came to UCC in a general science degree, which it was at the time, and then ended up in microbiology, which I really enjoyed. So I suppose in the final year, you get a research exposure, and that's really good to give you an idea of whether that's an area that you're interested in. I suppose, like a lot of science students, I did postgrad research because I wasn't really sure what else I could do or what I wanted to do. And as I alluded to earlier, I set off to do a PhD in UCD in the topic of immunology, which makes me laugh a lot when I think about it now, and worked really hard for about a year on a project that then just didn't go anywhere. And then literally just the project was pulled, which was a huge lesson for me to learn. It wasn't anything to do with my work. It was just that the PI decided that it wasn't a project that was going to be pursued. So I was kind of left there going, right, so what does that mean for me, you know? And in the interim, I was sort of sent to go off and work with these other people doing genetics in the other part of the lab. And I absolutely just loved it. And it just, I think about that a lot and where I might have ended up if I'd pursued immunology, and how that sort of what was for me a disaster at the time ended up being absolutely the thing that was meant to happen to me. I believe that. And I ended up in genetics, which I just love it. I just love everything about it. So I think I was always going to end up in science. How I ended up in genetics is slightly less direct, but have thoroughly enjoyed it, and the experiences I've had with it. You know, science is such a sort of an easy passport to lots of things. You know, it's on one hand, I suppose it's a bit frustrating because it's so open-ended and so broad. So it can be difficult sometimes to identify what it is that really interests you. But the flip side of that is just there's just so much, and you can go anywhere with it, you know. And I also think science is a great sort of international language as well. Science graduates or people involved in research have the opportunity to travel and visit other labs and be other places really easily. And that's an opportunity, I think, that all researchers and scientists should really exploit, because it makes it just enriches your life in so many ways. I was very fortunate to spend some years in Canada and just had a very good experience there professionally and personally. And it was because of a background and a research interest that just allowed me to do that. So I think there are huge opportunities there for us to move around and do other things or be other places. That's facilitated really easily by a science background or a research interest. Yeah,
that's super. It's really interesting to hear the kind of the winding road that led you to where you are now, Colette. Mm-hmm. So for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with molecular genetics and pathology in general, could you kind of give us a bit of an overview of what this involves and just kind of the process of, you know, identifying a link between a gene and the disorder and, you know, the importance of that in our understanding of medicine?
Sure. So, I mean... you know, there are very few disorders really that I think we would think don't have a genetic component. You know, some of them are very obvious single gene disorders, things like, you know, cystic fibrosis is a really big example of that. One gene is mutated and gives rise to a disorder. so those are very clear connections between gene defects and disorders. And then we have more complex traits, things that we know, disorders that run in families, let's say. We know that families have things like psoriasis. So we know that there's a genetic component in there, but it isn't just one single gene. We know that there's contributions of many, many genes. My interest has always been in single gene disorders. I think it's not that it's easier. I suppose it is on one hand a little bit easier to study them, but you're much more certain of your findings when you find them. It's less about numbers and statistics. It's a little bit more obviously translational or mechanistic. So the way we go about doing it, or that I've been doing it for many years, is always starts with patients and always starts with families. That's what it's always about. So a family will present, or a patient will present to a clinician. And we start to think about the genetic components of that. Maybe it's a disorder that we know is genetic, and we know genes that are involved. And so the process might be about looking at the genes in individuals in that family to try and identify if they have known mutations or if they have new mutations. Sometimes we don't know the genes that are involved at all, and we go on a gene hunt to try and find, well, what gene is involved in causing this disease. And that's a bit, I really enjoy it, is that kind of trying to find the answer to something. You know, this disease is caused because there's a genetic mutation, and we know there's a cause and we know there's a mutation, and it's a case of finding it and applying your knowledge in a way that makes finding it possible. So we've certainly moved more, I suppose, now into the world of next generation sequencing and asking all of the questions at once and getting all of the information and then trying to pair it back to find the bits that are significant or relevant. You know, prior to that, we would ask the questions about what pieces of DNA are being inherited by all the family members that have the disease. And so can we reduce from looking at everywhere in the genome to just maybe one chromosome or one portion of the chromosome? And so that process doesn't really have to relate to the type of disorder it is in any way, whether it's a cardiac disorder or a respiratory disorder or a skin disorder. That process is the same. And then once you've kind of highlighted a smaller area or region of interest, then you start thinking about, okay, so what do we know about this disease? What do we know about the phenotype? What kind of things do we know are occurring or are impaired, or what do we think is causing this disease? And then link that to the kind of genes or pathways that we know are located in that area of interest. And so connecting it then by using the information that we have about the disorder. And that's a very exciting kind of process of searching and finding and looking and confirming. And then you find a mutation, then you have to prove that it is connected, that it's not just a random change, that it's not something that we see in lots of the population. So that might run from obviously checking within the family that you have, that all the affected people have a change and the unaffected people don't, the inheritance makes sense, maybe collaborating with other people who've similar collections of families with the same disorder, seeing do they have mutations in the same gene, all the way up to functional studies to show, yes, you know, the chloride channel doesn't work in this cell, so this makes sense in terms of the disease. So it's quite a long process, but it's very enjoyable.
It certainly does sound like a very enjoyable kind of a lifelong problem-solving adventure you've stumbled upon there. Could you tell us, you've just touched on it briefly there, but could you tell us where you see genetic screening kind of evolving in the future in this, I guess, pursuit towards this utopia of fully personalised medicine?
Yeah, so I suppose that's always the dream, isn't it? That individuals, we understand their genetics, we understand their risks, and really it's about being able to manage or treat or intervene before they develop symptoms of a disease or identify that they're at risk of it. We're at a very interesting point in genetics. I suppose, you know, there have been milestones. I note that Gregor Mendel's 200th, the 200th anniversary of his birth is this year, so there'll be lots of genetics coming at us to commemorate that. But, you know, when we think of milestones or landmarks that have happened in genetics, that's obviously all of that. And then, you know, the publication of the genome, the human genome in the early 2000s, I mean, that was big. And now what I find we're at the point now is that we're at that point where we have a lot of public awareness of genetics from things like 23andMe and Ancestry.com and stuff, which on one hand is great, and the awareness and the understanding of genetics is probably broadened as a result of that. From the perspective of healthcare professionals, I think, you know, having a solid understanding of the genetics and what it means and how to interpret that information is what we're going to rely on. With the public awareness of genetics will come a demand for that information and a demand for the use of that information. We already in certain areas have, you know, increased demand for that molecular testing, which I'm all for, because, you know, unless we're treating the mechanism or the cause of the disease, we're only treating the symptoms, you know. So for example, you know, in cancer genetics, there's a huge demand now from clinicians for tumours to be sequenced or for mutations to be detected within tumours, because that has a very significant and real and immediate impact on how that patient is going to be managed or treated. So that world of personalised medicine is certainly, it's certainly on us in the world of sort of oncology and streamlining the types of treatment that individuals will be prescribed based on the mutation profile within their tumours. As to whether we'll ever get to the everyone has their genome screened and we utilise that every time you go to see your GP about something, I think we're a way off that. But a large body of work has to happen between now and then as well for the education of all healthcare professionals to understand all of this information, because we will have members of the public coming in with this data and asking people to interpret it or use it, you know, and that's a big shift from a physician requesting a genetic test and getting an answer, for people to come in with genetic information and ask for it to be interpreted. I think that's a change that we're going to have. But the power of genetics has become about numbers now, you know. And that's very exciting. Like there's huge amounts of information that's available and data that can be analysed and is being analysed. And actually companies like 23andMe and Ancestry.com are very heavily involved in research. And when you think about the potential of that in terms of the millions of DNA samples that are available, the potential for that to be used for very productive or fruitful research is enormous, you know. So it seems to always be an exciting time for genetics. That's what I'll say. Yeah.
And could you tell us a little bit about your more recent work in research? What are you looking into?
Yeah, so I do quite a varied sort of selection of genetic disorders. And I suppose that's another interesting point in that the approach that genetics uses doesn't rely or isn't constrained by certain types of disorders, you know. So, I mean, I've done an awful lot of sort of neurogenetics work throughout my career. I started off with an eye disorder. I've done lots of, as I say, neurogenetics. And I don't know why that is. I think neurologists tend to be very collaborative kind of individuals. That's what I've come up with. So work on things like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis those kind of sort of movement disorders or neurological disorders. I've moved, I suppose, in the last little while in more into the world of cancer genetics a little bit. So we have a nice study with collaborators in CUH in the histopathology department there on melanoma and the kinds of mutations that we see in melanoma in Irish patients and whether they look the same as the types of melanoma mutations we see in non-Irish patients. So that's very interesting because, again, that's another one of those disorders whereby the treatment is really directed by the kind of mutation that's present. So we really need to be sure that we're correctly identifying the kinds of mutation profile that we have and adjusting the regimes accordingly, you know, or the incidence according to the incidence of those mutations. I work on a disorder called restless leg syndrome, which sounds very funny and it's really not, which is a movement disorder. People get this urge to move their legs, irresistible urge, and they need to move around. And we've probably all experienced something a little bit like that, you know, when you're sitting in the cinema or on a plane or something, you know, but this is very extreme, very physiologically classified. We can see it. We can see it on sleep studies. We can see it on EMGs. And it's highly disruptive, obviously, to those individuals because it impairs their ability to sleep. We're certainly in a society now where we're becoming more and more aware of the need for sleep, and you know, we drive ourselves all the time and stay up late and we watch one more episode of something and then we spend the day caffeinating ourselves to get through it. So we are, I think, in the last few years becoming much more aware of the importance of sleep and the quality of sleep. So this is a sleep disorder which, you know, the social and economic impact of that is quite significant. So we've gathered quite a few Irish families who are trying to identify areas of their genome where there may be risk factors or genetic variants, I suppose, that change their risk for developing disease. So that's an interesting one that we have a few people working on at the moment. And as I said, some cancer genetics and melanoma, we have a glioma study yeah, different things. But I suppose a lot of neuro in there. Yeah.
And Colette, in the spirit of translational medicine, could you tell us a bit more about, I mean, you've touched on, you collaborate with clinicians in CUH and also with these patients who have these extremely rare genetic disorders. Could you tell us about the role that translational medicine has played so far in your career and perhaps where you see it evolving in the future as well?
All of my research has always been translational because it has always started with a patient sample. I've been trying to think if there was ever a time when there wasn't. And it really has always started with a patient or a family with a disorder. So, and the aim, while the work might be basic research in that we're trying to uncover the basic mechanism or underlying the disease. The aim is always that that information then becomes translated into a more effective diagnosis or a more effective, ideally a more effective or targeted treatment. So it's always been translational. It's always been about finding an answer for a patient or a family that have a disorder. And I think that's what kind of drives it, you know. Otherwise, it's just sort of there's no purpose to it, is there? So there's always been a patient or a family behind it. And as I say, trying to translate that understanding of the mechanism into something that's that can be applied to a patient starts with that basic research. You know, we don't develop drugs or targeted therapies for individuals from nowhere. They're based on many years of the basic research of the disorder or of the mechanism that's led to the development of that device or that treatment. So the aim is always in translating or having an impact on the patient or our families.
Super. And I'll throw two questions your way this time, Colette. So firstly, what has been a challenge that you faced along your career? And also then, what has been a major highlight of your career?
Okay. A challenge, I suppose, is research isn't always very exciting and isn't always working your way. There are times when things don't work very well. I think science as a career, there's a lot of rejection involved in it along the way, between having funding applications rejected or papers being rejected or things just not working out the way you thought they might. That can be challenging. On some days it's easy enough to take, and some days it's just a little bit harder to pick yourself up and go, right, what are we going to do next? And that is the challenge of research, I think. The fact that we don't have the answer is what research is about, you know. So sometimes we don't find the answer, or we don't, it doesn't work out the way we thought it was, and then we have to think about, well, what did I think, and did I do it correctly, and is my test right, or is the whole thing, was that a ridiculous idea, and sit back and think about that a little bit. So you don't always get the right answer, and that can be a challenge sometimes, but it's also the thing that keeps you going. It's a series of problem solving, isn't it? You know, it's putting up a theory or a hypothesis about something, and then trying to experiment your way through it, and then find what the results mean, and think about those, and try and analyze them in a way that makes sense, or sometimes in a way that you hadn't thought of before. So what could be the challenge can often be the bit that's exciting about it as well. In terms of highlights, I suppose, for research, I enjoy my teaching in UCC. I enjoy interacting with students. I think that's we get an awful lot of energy from that. But in terms of research, I think the highlight was probably when I was postdocing. I was just in a really big research centre with lots of people, and we were all researching all the time. It's all we did. And it was just sort of a good gang of people who understood what you were trying to do. And it had a really good sort of hierarchy, not hierarchy in a bad way, but, you know, there were senior postdocs, and there were postdocs, and there were postgrad students and undergrad students and summer students. And you just had an array of people with an array of experience, that we're all really, you know, quite willing to help each other, and that's a really supportive and transformative environment to be in, and you feel that you can achieve things because you have this support. And I just had a very good time there. I got good work done. I felt I was contributing very much, and I had a really fun time in a really nice city. So that was certainly, I think, in terms of research, a highlight for me, because it was purely research. It was all research all day, every day, which you know, when you take on an academic position, you don't have that luxury. So that was a good time in terms of research.
And what are some of the major changes in research you've observed since you started your career, Colette?
Okay, I suppose the big thing in terms of genetics is really the availability of genetic data. When I started, I'll out my age myself here now very publicly. When I started, we didn't have a genome, a draft genome, you know. So if you were interested in a gene, you had to do quite a lot of work to even figure out where it was. Whereas now we literally can click and find where something is and have a vast amount of information available to us. So that's been transformative in terms of genetics research. I think it's moved from having a single question, single answer approach to things, you know, which would be, is this gene mutated in this disorder, and set up your experiment to test that, to utilizing these enormous data sets of information, which is really asking all of the questions all at once. And on one hand, that's look, it's hugely powerful. You'll get huge amounts of information from that. But it becomes more about analysis than about a scientific question based on some information that you have. So that's a very different change. I think genetics has moved from that kind of, you know, connecting a certain gene with a certain disorder and asking those questions to analyzing a lot of data, finding some powerful statistics, and then asking your questions afterwards. So I think that that's probably the biggest change that's happened. That, and I suppose the public awareness of things like of genetics. Yeah, they'd be the big things I think that have changed.
And through your teaching as a lecturer in pathology, Colette, could you tell us how you aim to kind of engage students in your lectures and tutorials?
I should ask you guys, shouldn't I? So for me, it's all about why do we need to know this? when you're dealing with students, you constantly have to remind them why they need to know this, or why you feel they need to know this. And the other thing is about getting people to engage their brains and think. You know, I think science is very logical. It's not obvious, and I say that a lot. I won't insult or patronize people by saying this is really obvious, but it is logical, and so it should make sense to you. So that's where I try and get students to kind of realize that it should make sense, and if it doesn't make sense, then something's gone wrong along the way. You've misunderstood something, or someone said something incorrectly, or you've misinterpreted something, because it is logical. And I really believe that, like, we're in a world now of knowledge is cheap, isn't it? Like, we all have all of the information and more than we ever could even want at the touch of a button, or not even a button. So we've moved very much from, you know, being, I suppose, education before was about having knowledge. And now it's really much more about using knowledge. Anyone can have the knowledge, but it's about understanding it in a way that allows you to use it or interpret it. In many of my classes, I point out that, you know, we could just fuel the hospital emergency department with a semi-literate 12-year-old and an iPad, you know, and we all agree that we need more than that. So it's not just about Googling the answer to something and finding the answer. It's about understanding what that answer means and what to do next with the information. So I think that's what I try and get people to think and to realise it's about the mechanism. The mechanism explains everything. you know, otherwise it's symptoms. The symptoms help us understand the mechanism, but unless we're treating the mechanism, we're only just sort of treating the symptoms. So that's my approach, I think.
And Colette, what is the most exciting area of expanding research in the field of genetics, in your opinion, at the moment?
I suppose I've touched on a bit. It's this sort of large data set and using vast numbers of people. You know, before, you know, you could run a lab on having a handful of families of a certain disease, whereas now, you know, you read any sort of research paper and they're talking about, you know, we did whole genome sequencing on 57,000 people. You know, it's just it's vast. It's numbers. And I suppose part of me is not excited about that because it's not the bit of genetics that interests me, because that's just sort of it's data. But the other side of it is it's hugely powerful, hugely powerful. I read something recently, I think in terms of Americans, 1 in 5 Americans has participated in like Ancestry.com or 23andMe. So in terms of genetic data availability, that's just mind-blowing. People participate in those for different sorts of reasons, but the data is there and the data can and will be utilised, and I think there's enormous power in that as well. Now, we have to consider the scientific validity of some of those things, particularly if it's sort of self-reported tick boxes on a form, you know. Has anyone in your family ever had, you know, X disorder, and you tick it or not, and that's what the information is based on. So they all obviously have to be interpreted appropriately and then scientifically validated. But the power of genetics to explain things is enormous. And what's always, I suppose, appealed to me about genetics is the sort of the fact that your genetics are is what you are. It's the essence of you, and there's nobody else like you, and that's because of your genes. So I suppose to me, the fact that people hand that away to a company and pay them for it just amuses me. But I think it's an area where we will see, we have started to see, and we will see more and more of studies based on those. Kind of companies or consumer tests being utilized as sort of maybe almost sort of stage one or stage two of a research project to then identify areas of interest or areas of research to pursue in a different kind of structure. But I think the availability of genetic data is going to change things a lot.
And Colette, who or what inspires you?
I suppose it's the curiosity, it's the wanting to know the answer is the kind of thing that makes me want to do it all the time. I don't spend as much time in the lab as I'd like to, but when I do, I just still really enjoy it. I laugh, a few weeks ago I was in the lab with the student, and you know, I did a little happy dance in the lab, and it's just like I just still enjoy it. It just still makes me happy to be there. And when I do manage to get some time to think about research and to work on projects, it just makes me happy. I don't understand it. It's the questions, it's the possibilities, it's the thinking about, can I explain this? Thinking about, how can we test this? Finding the answer to something that maybe no one's found the answer to before. And that being something that's useful. It's a useful answer. It means that the patient will get the right drug. It means that even if we don't have a cure for that disorder, you know, if we know what mutations patients have, then they're ready if there is a clinical trial, you know, because, you know, so many of those trials now are very targeted based on the specific mutations that people have. So it's that wanting to know the answer and to be a useful answer, I suppose. That's what makes me want to do it.
Yeah, it's funny because I remember we had Professor Noel Cadiz on our podcast quite some time ago now, but he was adamant to point out that if you use curiosity as, I guess, the benchmark, it is the gold standard in terms of ensuring you have a long but also a satisfying career. And I think he encouraged students to ensure they get exposure to research as early as possible. And I know that you've been very generous in allowing students into your lab for summer internships over the years, Colette. And could you tell us why you feel this is such an important aspect of an undergrad studies, and perhaps any learnings you've taken from having these students in your lab in terms of their beginner's mindset and taking a completely fresh look at things?
Yeah, no, I mean, I just think anytime I think of research or what drives research, it's a curiosity or inquisitiveness or thinking about why is that that way or why is it not this other way, you know? So I do think that if you stop being excited about it, then it's maybe time to think doing something else, you know. If I go to the lab and it's not that I do a happy dance every day, I certainly don't, but you know, if you're not excited about doing it, then you know, it's maybe time to think again. I think I can't overemphasize the importance of research in an undergraduate program of something like science and medicine. It awakens that curiosity a little bit, or maybe stokes it a little bit for people who are curious. But it also, it just exposes you to a different way of thinking about things, and it transforms then how you think about things afterwards. I think the beauty of research is that it gives you this sort of space in which to ask questions. And if I think all the way back to my science teacher, that's what it was. He allowed us to ask questions. He got annoyed with most of them, but he allowed us to ask questions and be curious and to think, well, if that happens, what about this? And I think I love to see research programs built into undergrad programs, because I think it gives people that space to just ask the questions and realize we don't know all the answers, because sometimes I think people think we have all the answers and we don't. If we had all the answers, we'd be finished. It also, in terms of actually practical lab work, if you're involved in that kind of research, you know, apart from the practical skills that you acquire, you start to interpret things or findings or other papers differently, because you just say, hang on now, that's not the right control for that study, or I don't really agree with how you've presented that work. And you just become a little bit more aware that you can be critical of things, and you don't have to just accept this paper says this. Well, you can challenge it and say, well, I do agree with this bit, or I'm not happy about that. And it allows you to kind of question that a little bit more. And then I think that means that you question everything a little bit more, and that's good. You know, don't just sit there and say, well, that's what they said, so that's fine. Think about, well, why is it that way and why is it not some other way? So it is about driving that curiosity, but giving people, I suppose, the place to be curious and to have those questions and ask them. In terms of summer students, yeah, people do it for different reasons. And it's exciting because they come in and they're all very shiny and excited about things. The speed at which they gather skills often surprises them, you know. Things that take an awful lot of time to do in the first week become really easy to do, you know, after a few weeks, oh, I'll just pop in and do that experiment, you know. And so from a practical point of view, people can acquire those skills, which can transfer across loads of different areas. But I think it's just about having that questioning and thinking about how do we ask the question, what experiment will answer this question, and then when we get the answer, what does it mean and what do we do next? And I do think it changes how you think about an awful lot of things, even if you don't end up doing research. I think there's this thing about doing research, and we're all exposed to research all the time, whether we think we're doing it or not. And just challenging what we're being told about things and being curious and not stopping asking the questions.
Super. And now we're coming to the end of the show, Colette. So what's one piece of advice that you would give the younger version of yourself that we as college students can learn from?
Right, the younger version of me would never have come to a radio station to talk about things. The younger version of me would never have emailed a lecturer to say, do you have a spot in your lab this summer? I want to do some research. And they're the things, I suppose, that you get as you realise the opportunities that you have, you know. when I think now, and it wasn't that I didn't have lovely lecturers, I did, but you just didn't really talk to them or approach them unless there was an issue. And I think now that I would hope that that's changed hugely, and that people are more approachable. It's about opportunities and asking. You know, if you're interested in doing research, email someone and say, I'm interested in doing research. Do you have a spot? As my mum would say, the worst thing that can happen is they'll say no, like that's it. And you have to accept that maybe they'll say no, and that's okay. But, you know, what did it? It didn't take much for you to ask the question. And you never know what kind of opportunities might come from that. It's about opportunities and understanding, I suppose, that science isn't, you know, it's a challenge. It is. It doesn't always work out beautifully, and that can be very frustrating. And I think particularly for science students, you need to experiment with research and see is it a fit for you. Some scientists, you know, don't enjoy that process. Don't like the fact that there's just more questions to be asked, and some just are driven by that. So take opportunities, see what they are, recognize the opportunities for what they are. Talk to people. If someone is doing something that you're interested in, talk to them, email them, ask them. If somebody inspires you, then have a chat with them about what you can do and if you can work together or what tips they have. Find somebody that will kind of champion you or mentor you, I think is really important as well, because science can be a little bit different, you know. And if you don't understand, you know, it's a kind of a slightly different world, I suppose. And if you have like that, if you have that nice, good lab structure and you've got loads of people to bounce ideas off, and you learn an awful lot and you give a lot. And that's a very nice sort of community spirit, almost, of a really nice, well working lab. So I would tell my younger self to take more chances and take more opportunities and talk to people, because, you know, it's often the people, you know, that you connect with that by chance that things work out, and sometimes they won't. That's the other thing, you know. But take some opportunities and push on, and you won't always get the answer you want, but that's okay as well.
Super. Well, thank you so much for coming on today, Colette. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much. It's been fun.